Today on Maine Calling, Coca-Cola and Public Health, a history of deception, an encore presentation. Coca-Cola is by far the best-selling brand name beverage in the world. It's estimated that more than a billion, yes, billion, 8-ounce servings of Coke are consumed in the world every day. Each can contains the equivalent of 10 teaspoons of sugar. Public health officials have long known that Coke and other sugar-sweetened drinks play a big part in the epidemic of chronic disease, type 2 diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, osteoporosis. But most people don't know this. Why? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we listen back to our earlier program with investigative journalist Murray Carpenter. His new book, Sweet and Deadly, chronicles Coca-Cola's long history of deceiving the public on many fronts. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Verrill, committed to delivering trusted legal services in Maine and throughout the Northeast for 163 years. Learn more at verrill-law.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Few brands are more American than Coca-Cola. It is everywhere, from sporting events to convenience stores. But simply put, it's bad for you. A new book examines how Coke became so ubiquitous and how the corporation has misled consumers about its health harms. My guest today is Murray Carpenter. He is a journalist and author whose earlier book was Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. And he's a former reporter, of course, for Maine Public Radio, a former colleague of ours. Murray's new book is called Sweet and Deadly, How Coca-Cola Spreads Disinformation and Makes Us Sick. We invite you to join the conversation. Did you grow up drinking Coke? Have you tried to cut down on sugary drinks? Join our conversation. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Murray, welcome back to Maine Calling, and congratulations on the book.
Thanks, Jennifer. It's great to be here. We talked about caffeine, gosh, 11 years ago.
Was that 11 years ago? Now you're making me feel old. But speaking of Caffeinated, your first book, Murray, that was really what set you on the path for the second book, right? Sweet and Deadly.
Yeah, absolutely. So in reporting that book, one of my surprises was that the caffeinated beverage we consume most by volume is sodas, so not coffee or tea. And, you know, that happened, it was a pretty abrupt change in our dietary habits from about 1950 to 2000, when we really went from drinking a lot more coffee and a lot more milk as a beverage to a lot more sodas. In that 50 years, we went from like 10 gallons of soda per person per year to 50. And so, you know, I got really interested in that because people would say, hey, is my caffeine habit healthy for me? And my pat response would be, well, it may well be, but try to avoid sodas. So that got me looking at the health risks of sodas.
Mm. And so let's talk about Coca-Cola specifically. Why is it, Murray? Why is it that Coca-Cola is so good? There's a reason it's so popular.
Yeah, it's really hard to describe. I mean, so the formula certainly of sweet, carbonated, caffeinated, and cold, and convenient, you know, as the Coke slogan that they've long used is within arm's reach of desire. When you have something that's everywhere accessible, tastes so good to most people, it's really hard to battle that. And again, because I view things through a caffeine-centric lens, I think, you know, the caffeine is driving part of this, but a lot of people are really attracted to the sweetness of it too. And it's just, it's kind of hard to argue with its appeal because Coca-Cola, you know, has really conquered the world. It's everywhere. People love it. People love it.
And you talk a little bit about the flavoring, right? It's a different kinds of, more than one kind of sugar in it. Is it the phosphorus that's in the carbonation?
Phosphoric acid. Yeah. So it sort of it gives you like a little bit of a bitterness, and the caffeine gives you kind of a bitter bite to it as well. And then of course the sugar, it's sort of hitting all of these sensory modes at the same time, you know, and the carbonation is sort of tingling on your tongue. I think the cold, you know, the fact that most of us don't like a lukewarm Coca-Cola, having it served cold is a big part of it. It's just sort of giving you a lot of appealing sensations all at the same time. And, you know, we should note a lot of the imitators are very, very similar. You know, Pepsi, there's the old Pepsi challenge, right? I've even done this taste test with one of my friends, like to see if they can really tell the difference. It's hard to tell the difference, but they've hit on a winning formula. It's got great appeal.
One of the points you make in your book, though, is that not only is Coca-Cola, you don't use the phrase bad for us, but I'll say bad for us. Not only is it not good for our health, but it's uniquely bad for us. Something about it is the way it's delivered, the way it goes into your body and goes into the different systems of your body, is sort of uniquely harmful. Can you explain that?
Yeah, and that was the words of one of my sources, Frank Hu at the Harvard School of Public Health. And it's a combination of things. One, you know, the sugars are harmful in and of themselves. When you're consuming this much refined sugar, you know, all at once, it's affecting your metabolism in different ways that are harmful. It's the fact that it's liquid. And one of the things about liquids that we know, and one of the effects of sugar of liquid sugars, is it's really easy to overindulge. You know, the nutritionists have this term satiety, which is basically satisfaction, being, you know, the sense of being full. So it's you can have a Coke with your meal, and the Coke doesn't make you feel any more full, but it's adding an awful lot of calories. So you can overindulge in it. There are health risks from the sugars, and it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. It's very popular. So the combination of, you know, the fact that we're consuming a lot of it, it's easy to overindulge in it, and it's really pretty much we're immersed in it. These make the health risks sort of unique.
So if you have a big brownie or a big chocolate chip cookie, you might be full and you might not also eat that Big Mac and fries. But if you have a great big soda, you might have just as many calories and still eat everything else.
Yeah. And this goes back to a discussion that we've had a lot in this country since the 1980s. You know, when we swung hard towards low fat diets in the 1980s, I think if you saw a tray of someone at McDonald's and they had a Big Mac and fries and then a 20-ounce Coke on the tray, we would tend to focus on the Big Mac and fries as the harmful element of that diet. And so for a long time, I think did not focus enough on the risk of sugar sweetened beverages, and all of that started to change. I'd say around 2000 when there was a greater emphasis on looking at the harms of sugar sweetened beverages.
Yeah. So that's part of the, you know, what you've written about and explored, Murray, is how kind of late we all came to understanding the harms. And there's a reason we all came to this pretty late. Not until the 2000s did we realize obesity, diabetes, heart disease, osteoporosis, that sugary soda, specifically Coke, were really contributing to these epidemics. Why do we not know this? And I know you wrote a whole book about it, but why did we for so many years not really know it?
Well, and this is really interesting to me because there's a parallel here, a strong parallel to tobacco. We talk a lot about the tobacco playbook, and, you know, sort of in short, that's this idea of it's a campaign to discredit existing science, promote science that supports your perspective, use a public relations campaign to boost your product, and then also use front groups to sort of put yourself at arm's length from those products. Well, one of the interesting things I found out, I have a very interesting source, Kristen Kearns, who's a dentist who became an academic, who mined a bunch of sugar archives. And what she found was that when one of the first tobacco sort of front groups was hiring its first staff. They hired him directly from a sugar association. And in his application, he outlined that exact tobacco playbook that I just described. So put another way, Coke has been at this for longer than tobacco, and I would argue sort of more effectively, because they still have sort of this halo effect, and tobacco has been, you know, vilified. So yeah, there's been a long strategy of working to hide the health risks of sodas from the American consumer.
A long time, multiple decades, decades of deception. You talk about front groups, Murray. What do you mean by that? That Coca-Cola, just like the tobacco companies, have front groups?
So these are groups, and they're different types. But one of them, for example, that I became very interested in is the International Life Sciences Institute, and it's a good example. They often have a benign, sort of benevolent sounding name. Industry supported and often working, not overtly, but they clearly working to promote the interests of the industry that supports them. So International Life Sciences Institute, for example, was founded by a Coca-Cola executive and consistently churned out research and papers that specifically did not cast blame on sugars. And so, you know, that's one of the way that they use front groups. They've also used front groups really creatively in sort of electioneering and even in initiative campaigns.
So what they've tried to do is they've tried to muddle the science. So for every article that comes out that says sugar sweetened beverages contribute to diabetes, they put out three or four with some doctor or PhD's name on it, some connected to some group, maybe with a university, that says, whoa, wait a minute, we're not sure about that.
Yep, exactly. To muddle the science and also to sort of flood the zone on the other side. And this is maybe looks less nefarious. Some people call this industrial dilution or industrial distraction, but it's the idea. So, for example, one of the controversies I cover is about the Global Energy Balance Network. And the whole focus of that front group was to focus on the calories outside of the equation. So not focus on what you're consuming, but focus on, you know, what you're burning off. And so by sort of emphasizing that aspect of the science, you suck up some of the oxygen in the room. You focus a lot of the research dollars in that one area, and then there's going to be less conversation about the, you know, what you're consuming, which is the concern.
Murray, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that was one of the most fascinating things to me in the book, this whole idea of calories in, calories out, that you just need to burn as many calories as you eat and then you'll lose weight, something we've all heard our whole lives. That was something that came from Coca-Cola.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things that they've emphasized so strongly over the years is all calories, you know, like really calories, a calorie is a calorie is a calorie. And the only place that's really true is what nutritionists use is, I think it's called a bomb calorimeter. I don't know, but it's a device for measuring calories. And so if you burn a calorie of, say, sugar and a calorie of cashews in this device, yes, eat your calorie. But in the human body, of course, we're not metabolizing sugar and kale and cashews in the same way. And so in the human body, emphatically, a calorie is not a calorie. We metabolize them differently. And that has been a message that Coca-Cola and its allies have really tried to hammer, is that a calorie is a calorie. And but no, there's quality. Their calories obviously have different qualities.
And they've tried to say to all of us that the reason there's such obesity in this country is because there are too many video screens. There are too many. We're not burning enough calories. I love the part, housewives aren't working as hard as they used to. These messages are all from Coca-Cola. And even though they've been discredited, there are articles, I mean, excuse me, there are organizations that are legitimate organizations. I'm thinking of the Boys and Girls Club, who have adopted this philosophy.
Yeah. And it's true. And it's interesting because, of course, there's a kernel of truth in that. If you're less active, you're going to be less fit. I mean, that's true. That's 100% true. But emphasizing that side of the equation really is problematic when, you know, what's really changed most dramatically and most profoundly over, say, the past 50 years is the diet and not the activity. Both matter. But it's really important to focus on the nutrition, the nutritional aspect. And that's the part, yes, that Coca-Cola wants to turn, you know, avert our eyes from. They would rather us not look at that. And, you know, their use of front groups in this way is really interesting to me because they're sort of thinking always three moves ahead on the chessboard, you know, and where nutrition advocates are saying, hey, you want to avoid sodas, they're unhelpful. Coke is already thinking, well, hey, how about if we develop a front group, and how about if we fund these universities, and how about if they produce papers? And they've been very, very effective in most cases at sort of focusing the public conversation in those areas.
Well, you know, since about the year 2000, there has been more awareness, I would think, and more information out there about the damage that sugary sodas can cause. And I'm wondering, Murray, have we seen a dip in soda beverage consumption? And if so, what is the reaction of Coca-Cola?
Yeah, so there has been. The peak was about the year 2000. When I talked about our shifting dietary habit earlier, like in 1950, we were drinking about 40 gallons each of milk and of coffee and about 10 gallons of soda. And then coffee and milk dipped dramatically, and that's when soda went to 50 gallons per person. Since then, it's like in that decade after 2000, we've seen a modest reduction, 20-25%. The reduction seems to have leveled off, but it is definitely a decline. And again, I think that's part of the reason I was very much interested in focusing on the decade that I did most of my reporting on in this book, 2000 to 2020, is because I think Coke and its allies were really feeling the heat at that point. The public was starting to get the memo. They're really starting to change their habits, and Coke was trying to react to that because obviously if you know, that hurts their business model, if people stop consuming Coke. So a decline, and then I think sort of more recently the decline has been less abrupt. So I think we're still close to 40 gallons, maybe 8 to 10 ounces per person per day of sugar-sweetened beverages, which is also, you know, it's kind of interesting to think about the consumption because it's skewed. For everyone who's not consuming any Coca-Cola, you have someone who's consuming, you know, 16 ounces a day. And so, yeah, there has been a decline for sure.
And also Coke has countered, haven't they, by marketing more in the rest of the world?
They've been marketing more in the rest of the world, and they've been trying to get more money per ounce by marketing smaller serving sizes, which some people like in the U.S. It doesn't seem to be dramatically decreasing production, but you know, they're still doing an awful lot of you know, so-called volume of soda sales here. I went to the corner store this morning and I picked up this bottle of Coke, and it's 20 ounces. And so, I mean, it's the eye level product when you walk into the store. It's the one that's, you know, best promoted. And this one has 65 grams of sugar. I mean, it's an awful lot of sugar in these products. And it's hard to visualize 65 grams, but if you say you had one of these 20-ounce bottles every day for lunch for 2 weeks, then picture like a 2-pound box of sugar, then you would have consumed that in 2 weeks.
Wow, so if 39 grams of sugar is about 10 teaspoons, we're talking about like something like, what, I'm just trying to do quick math in my head, 16 or 17 teaspoons of sugar in one of those bottles.
Yeah, I mean, it's for anyone who's done baking or, you know, home concoctions, it's hard to get that amount of sugar in solution, right? In that amount of water, it's a lot. And you know, put another way, say you went out with a friend and they had a 12-ounce ordered iced tea, and they got a 12-ounce glass of unsweetened iced tea, and then they put 10 bags of sugar in it. You'd say, you know, hey man, that's a lot. But you know, that's what you're getting with 10, you know, little sugar bags. That's what you would get with the equivalent Coke.
We're talking with Murray Carpenter. His new book is Sweet and Deadly: How Coca-Cola Spreads Disinformation and Makes Us Sick. What are your questions for Murray? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our topic today, Coca-Cola and its practice of deception when it comes to public health. My guest today is investigative journalist Murray Carpenter. You probably know his voice from his time here at Maine Public Radio. He's also reported for NPR, The New York Times, and many other organizations. He's the author of the new book, Sweet and Deadly: How Coca-Cola Spreads Disinformation and Makes Us Sick. We invite you to join the conversation. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Murray, we haven't really talked that much, just very briefly, about the health impact of sugary sodas, especially Coca-Cola. But we are talking major problems in America, the group of diseases known as metabolic disorder, as well as osteoporosis, cavities. So lay it all out there. What are we seeing? What is Coca-Cola causing?
Okay, so you hit cavities right off, and there's a big one. And I didn't spend a lot of time on that in my book, but it is one of the interesting things, because that is one that became very much of an issue in the 1940s, 1950s, in the sort of first wave of pushback. And it's one of the things you saw Coke's PR campaign pushing back against. But yeah, associated with oral health and cavities for sure. One of the really big ones is type 2 diabetes. And, you know, this is the condition that we develop if over time we're not able to produce enough insulin to process the sugars that we're consuming. And one can, like one 12-ounce can of Coke a day, is associated with a 25% increased risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Now we have, I think, almost 1 in 10 Americans are dealing with type 2 diabetes. It's a very, very major problem. And, you know, we can talk briefly if you want. I don't want to get too wonky about the differences between how we metabolize glucose and fructose, but the type 2 diabetes is directly related to how we metabolize the glucose in the Coca-Cola. It's also very strongly associated with an increased risk for developing obesity and overweight in children and in adults. And again, just one can a day. And also an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, fatty liver disease, which is an increasing problem, and even gout. So there's a whole suite of diseases. And, you know, a lot of times we sort of lump these under the idea of chronic disease or diseases of lifestyle, which have become increasingly a concern here in America and globally.
And also osteoporosis.
Yeah. And that's something that I didn't focus on. But yeah, I mean, there's so many issues here.
We have a few emails coming in from Scott. I'm a 64-year-old Coke drinker. I wish I weren't, but I am. I wish to disagree with your guest. To taste the two colas, couldn't be more dissimilar. Pepsi, sticky sweet. Coke has bitter aftertaste. If I were served a Pepsi in a restaurant, I sent Pepsi back and ordered root beer. So Murray, you know, this kind of speaks though to a little bit about how Coca-Cola, your book is about Coca-Cola, it's not about sugary beverages, how Coca-Cola has really got its claws into us. And for many reasons, the taste, the marketing, it's undeniable.
It is. And so I love getting this email, because I would love to have this conversation, because I really think if you do a taste, like, I'll trust that this listener really can discern the difference. But a lot of people, I think, cannot if you do a blind taste test. But yeah, you know, and the reason I bring that up is because the marketing is so much part of it. You see the red and white lettering on the label, and you want that beverage. But yeah, regardless, I mean, people will say, yeah, Pepsi maybe has even a more citrusy flavor or something. But yeah, they're both very palatable. But Coke, you know, Coke is really, they sell something like twice as much Coke, original Coke, as original Pepsi in the country. So a lot of people really do prefer it, and it's been marketed very well.
An email here from Dawn. I'm curious about the strength of beverages like Coke that came out over 100 years ago. Before refrigerators, I'm thinking these drinks were meant to be served over ice and were naturally diluted rather than straight up like we drink it today. Maybe we drink it wrong now and in quantities, large single servings that were never imagined. Thoughts?
Yeah, so definitely the latter. The quantity is much, much greater. I mean, I'll date myself, but you know, when I was a kid, if you had went to the soda machine and you pulled out a soda, it would typically be the 10-ounce glass bottle. And that, you know, seems really quaint in retrospect, that size. 100 years ago, well, I mean, back in the early 1900s, even 120 years ago, Coke had a lot more caffeine. The servings then were about 8 ounces. So I'm not exactly sure how much sugar they had, but they were definitely a much, much smaller serving size back then. And again, the big increase in quantity started around 1950 and up to 2000. But yeah, we definitely, in the old days, we drank much smaller servings and fewer of them.
Yeah, and when you say fewer of them, I'm going to date myself here, but I remember when having something like a Coke was a treat. It was almost, you know, equivalent to, you know, having an ice cream sundae or something like that. You went on a picnic and your mom let you have a Coke. And now not only are people drinking it every day and sometimes with every meal, but they're driving around with maybe a big gulp, like some giant drink in a plastic cup with a straw.
Yeah, it's the way we've consumed them is very different. And you often see young people walking around with like the 20-ounce bottle that I referenced earlier. Even as Cokes started getting bigger, say in the late 1980s, early 1990s, at that point, I think most of us remember that, you know, a 16-ounce bottle looked pretty big. They've just gotten bigger. And yeah, the fountain drinks, often 20, 24 ounces, the serving sizes have gotten bigger. And yeah, the regularity of consumption, not just something you have, you know, on a family picnic on a Sunday afternoon as a treat, but more sort of a staple of the diet.
We'll go to Joyce, who's calling from Greenfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Joyce. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a naturopathic physician, and it's really interesting that MDs are known not to be trained in medical school in either nutrition or environmental medicine or lifestyle choices. And this is one of the reasons why this has happened, because naturopathic doctors could help people to make better choices. And naturopathic doctors have been considered to be quacks over the years.
Yeah. So Joyce, thanks so much for calling in. And Murray, you talk about this a lot, about how Coca-Cola has tried to influence the medical community. And you know, to Joyce's point, that most MDs do not get nutrition training in medical school. You know, you've got one set of facts on one side, but nothing strongly counterbalancing it on the other side.
Yeah, this is fascinating. It's a very good point. I mean, I think there's been a lot of criticism of sort of modern medicine in treating the symptoms of disease and not looking closely enough at prevention. I'd like to think that most GPs now are able to have this conversation with their patients about diet, particularly if the patients are concerned about some of these chronic diseases that are associated with sugar-sweetened beverages. I think that's happening more often, but yeah, I think we probably came late to this. I think we came late to the idea of it being sort of a first question that you would ask someone who's coming in presenting with one of these chronic diseases. What is your soda habit? So, yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, early in my research, I spent some time with Greg Glassman, who founded CrossFit. And he was at that time going around and talking to MDs about nutrition and exercise, and found, I would say, a very engaged audience. I went to a hospital with him in Boston. And so I'd say, yeah, the medical community is interested. But yeah, I can't disagree that it's been sort of a long time coming. And I think we could get more momentum from the medical community towards reappraising our soda habits.
Joyce, thanks so much for your call. Let's see here. We'll go to an email from Deborah. I was not allowed soda as a child. History, my grandfather had run the Martha's Vineyard Coke Bottling Company, and it showed my mother what would happen if you left a nail or washer in Coke overnight. I never developed a taste for any kind of soda and wonder about the effects of allowing children to have soda. Does this set them up for life?
Yeah, well, I mean, the nail and the washer, I mean, I've heard anecdotally people who had a classroom demonstration of like leaving a tooth in a glass of Coke. I never saw any of those things. So, but I would imagine something about the acidity of it would have a corrosive effect. There is growing concern or significant concern about children, not just because developing overweight or obesity at a young age puts you on a trajectory to maintain that over time, but there's also the concern about sort of how you develop a preference for sweets and sweetness and a taste for sweetness and how that can lead to overconsumption. So this is it is a big thing, and the consumption levels remain pretty high among children of sugar sweetened beverages. So yeah, it is a concern, and I think people are paying more attention to it. You know, you don't get sodas in schools anymore, for example.
Kurt, Marie, I want to ask you about federal spending. We know that, or I didn't know, but I read in your book that people who have what used to be called food stamp benefits, now called SNAP, can buy sodas using SNAP benefits. Those same people then often have these chronic diseases, and benefits like Medicaid help them get that, you know, it pays for them to be treated for those conditions. Is there an estimate of how much money do we as taxpayers spend because of Coca-Cola?
Well, it's a tremendous amount. It's not just that they're available through SNAP, but they're the single sugar sweetened beverages are the single item that the top single purchase with SNAP. Estimates range from $6 billion to over $10 billion a year. And this is, you know, one of the things we don't, because USDA has not issued waivers to allow states to experiment, Maine has requested one to say, hey, can we disallow the purchase of sugar sweetened beverages to see what happens? Because USDA has not allowed that, we don't really have an experiment to know, you know, data to know if you disallow this, would soda consumption decline? I think we can say, you know, probably. But the really interesting thing that's happened just really over the past week is that the new Secretary of Health and Human Services, Bobby Kennedy, has said he will issue waivers so that USDA can allow states to start restricting this practice. It's fraught. You know, when there was a bill to do this in Maine, gosh, around 2010. And one of the concerns, of course, is that advocates for people who have low incomes who are using SNAP feel like they can be stigmatized by you saying, you know, you should drink this, you can't drink that, etc. But yeah, it's an awful lot of money. I suspect it's over $10 billion annually. And Coke has fought vigorously, of course, to maintain that.
We'll go to Barbara calling from Harrison. Hi, Barbara, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had the perfect cure for taking soda out of your diet. About 50 years ago, when I lived in New York, I worked for PepsiCo International Headquarters in Purchase, and part of the job of the employees was to test out the new Diet Pepsi ingredients, and they were horrible. And that totally cured me from drinking soda for the rest of my life so far. I'm in my 70s and don't touch the stuff. I'm very healthy. I'm not on, and I don't have any illnesses. I'm not on any medications. I have a normal weight for my age and size. And so I think sodas are poison.
Barbara, thanks for your call. Murray?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting, of course, that they would allow employees to sample the beverage. I guess they had a captive audience. I can say diet beverages, I think the taste, the flavor has improved since your experience, just judging by the popularity of Diet Coke and Diet Pepsi. They're, of course, a lot of people, when they see this book, what they say is, hey, man, just whatever you do, do not go after the diet drinks. And the book does focus on sugar. There are health risks associated with diet drinks, but they're different.
Barbara, thanks for your call. We do need to go to another quick break. We're talking with author Murray Carpenter about his new book, Sweet and Deadly, How Coca-Cola Spreads Disinformation and Makes Us Sick. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Calling. Today we're talking about Coca-Cola and the impact that sugary soft drinks have had on our culture and the health of our nation. My guest, Murray Carpenter, he's a print and radio journalist, and his new book is Sweet and Deadly, How Coca-Cola Spreads Disinformation and Makes Us Sick. Share your comments and questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram if you're quick, or call 1-800-399-3566. Murray, how come there are not warning labels on sugary beverages?
Yeah, this is something I get into in the book. It's a challenge because nutrition advocates, health advocates have long argued for them. The nation of Chile has, they have really prominent warning labels on sodas since about, 2016. And they've led to a very significant decline in soda consumption. So advocates say they work, and they're just an effective strategy, public health strategy. In the one case I cover in the book in San Francisco, the warning label that was proposed by the city of San Francisco met fierce resistance, particularly from the American Beverage Association and a very good lawyer for the American Beverage Association. And the concern is that there's concerns about why they were singling out this one product as opposed to, say, ice cream, and concerns about the accuracy of the health risks on the label. So any effort at labeling, I think, will get great pushback from the industry. But we know also from the tobacco analogy that warning labels are can be a very effective public health strategy. So I think you'll see more efforts at doing it. It's going to be quite a project to try to get any of these implemented.
I'm wondering too, have there been any class action lawsuits? I'm thinking, if we know now, and as you outlined very effectively in your book, that Coca-Cola and the American Beverage Association has been, in a very calculated way, deceiving the public about the harms, the health harms of Coca-Cola and other sugary beverages, and we have a diabetes epidemic and obesity epidemic, it seems to me that somebody, some attorney, would have instigated a class action lawsuit.
Well, nothing notable. And, I did cover this one case pitting two pastors against the American Beverage Association and Coca-Cola in D.C. But that's different. And I think one of the challenges is, I interviewed people in the book who definitely had health problems they attributed to Coke. The challenge is it's quite different. First of all, it's worth remembering it took decades for any class action lawsuits to be effective against tobacco. It's just a high bar. It takes a long time. And another thing that makes it a little bit more difficult with sugar sweetened beverages, I think, is that they tend to affect the health, as we've discussed, in a lot of different ways. And whereas with tobacco, you had emphysema and lung cancer that weren't often seen in non-smokers. And even there, it was a challenge to meet a lawsuit. So I think the legal challenge would be huge, but I wouldn't be surprised if you start seeing some efforts at some point.
I'm going to read you an email, Murray, but it's one of several. A lot of people asking a similar question. Can you comment on Diet Coke, which seems equally addictive but has substitute sweeteners instead of sugar? Is it also harmful?
So, yes. This is really interesting. There's a lot of science about this. There are some harms associated with diet drinks. Some of this has to do, again, with our perception of sweetness and how that affects appetite. Some of this has to do with how diet sodas affect our gut biota. Diet sodas can sort of trick your body into increasing your blood glucose levels because they taste sweet. I think the best, again, going back to one of my trusted sources, Frank Hu, what his recommendation is, they can be a great transition beverage if you're trying to get rid of sodas, sugar sweetened sodas that you can transfer to diet sodas. I don't think it's, I think I'm comfortable saying, and this is completely subjective, that I think the risks of diet sodas are far less than the risks of full sugar sodas. But what I would really suggest if you want to have a beverage is, think about unsweetened tea, something like that. I know it sounds really boring compared to a diet soda, which has all of those things that we talked about that make it so good. But it'll get you a little bit of caffeine and a little bit of hydration, and it's perfectly healthful.
An email here from James. My father trained as a dentist in the late 1940s and made us kids aware of nutrition and dental health. We never had sodas except for a little 7-Up for a sore throat. I find highly sweetened food and drink gross and unappetizing, I think because I didn't develop a taste for such things as a kid. And I'm so glad that James brought up the dentist, Murray. I'm going to tell you a little story. I remember one day I had a dentist appointment. It happened to be on Halloween. And I said to my dentist, I said, I bet this is your favorite day of the year, jokingly. And he said, I actually don't mind Halloween because kids, they eat the candy and then they brush their teeth. And he said, what bothers me is people that have a sugary beverage in their car or at their desk all day and sip from it all day.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that habit of sipping from a sugar sweetened beverage and, it's slightly acidic, definitely can contribute to cavities. And again, that was one of the things that led the dentist, Kristen Kearns, on her journey into researching the history of sodas, is that she was wondering why do we not discuss this more? Why do we not talk more about the risks? A lot of times people talk about prevention. You want to brush your teeth instead of saying, avoid these drinks. But yeah, there's definitely a strong risk for developing cavities with drinking sugar sweetened beverages. And the other comment that in that email is, they are so sweet that if you're not used to drinking sodas and then you try one for a while, you'll be surprised at just sort of how sweet it can taste to you. You acquire that taste for sweetness.
I'll go to Torbert calling from York. Hi, Torbert. Go ahead.
Good morning, Jennifer and Murray. I would like to make a historical, analytical observation that I think this joint venture of medicine and Coca-Cola and Pepsi are all rooted in the patent medicine craze of the late 19th and early 20th century, in which charlatans sold medicine. It's going to make you feel better. And of course it made you feel better because it had cocaine in some and heroin in the others. And that's the general gist of modern medicine. Get you hooked and not cure you. And when I was a child, cane sugar was hegemonic in soft drinks. And now we have corn syrup, and because of Archer Daniels, Midland, and their power, the corn lobby.
Yeah, two things there that are good points, Torbert. Thank you for that. So, Murray, the one that Coca-Cola wasn't indeed, as Torbert said, developed as a medicine in the first place.
Yeah, the patent medicine, I think it's sort of parent concoction was Vin Mariana, and it was a knockoff of that, but it was basically a slightly alcoholic and beverage with cocaine. I mean, it would have made you feel really, really good. This is before Coke sort of transitioned into its It's early 1900s product. So yeah, that is the roots of this stuff. The high fructose corn syrup is a topic of great conversation. You know, people say they prefer Mexican Coke because, you know, it has cane sugar. The really notable thing about high fructose corn syrup is that it's so cheap and so available that it really got into every product, you know, starting in the late 80s and 90s. And it's kind of in everything in it. And it's the sweetener in most Coca-Colas.
We'll go to Evan, who's calling from Bridgeton. Hi, Evan, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just wanted to point out that I've heard of Coca-Cola as a cleaning agent in sinks, toilets, and for a clogged drain, you pour it and let it sit overnight, and it's pretty good.
Thanks, Evan. Go ahead, Murray.
I've heard that too, and I've not yet tried it. But yeah, it must have. Anyway, it's worth trying. I'll try to clean something after the show.
Yeah, and similar. Anne writes, in the 50s and 60s, my father had a welding shop. He would use Coca-Cola and rusted screws and things that he couldn't undo. He wouldn't let us drink it. I'm going to go to an email from Mary, a quick one, Murray, but probably a big answer here. I am interested in what the company does politically.
Yeah, well, so Coca-Cola politically, and there's some of this in this book, I would say they very sort of thoughtfully spread the wealth around. So they're well connected to a lot of high-powered politicians on both sides of the aisle. And to give you an example, there are scenes in the book with Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, who were somewhat allied with Coca-Cola. And then more recently, and it's not in the book, of course, Coca-Cola CEO James Quincy went to the White House to give Donald Trump like a commemorative bottle of Diet Coke, which apparently he has a button on his desk with which he summons a Diet Coke when he wants it. So yeah, politically, I would say they're savvy and they're well connected.
An email here from Eddie. I wish you'd speak more about the harms of Coke itself as opposed to other sodas and sugared drinks. Is it that Coca-Cola, Murray, is worse for you, or is it just that it has the market dominance?
It has the market dominance. So the reason I focused on Coke, and it's not to say that it's any worse for you than, say, Pepsi or Dr. Pepper or even, dare I say it, Moxie. But it's far and away the dominant product, not only in America, but worldwide, vastly outsells the other products, but also because they've really been the more aggressive in terms of pushing these front groups and these alternate strategies of disinformation, more so than Pepsi, for example, which, to be clear, also does this, but not as effectively and strategically as Coca-Cola does it.
We'll go to Vinny in Brownfield. Vinny, we're tight on time, so please ask your question quickly. Thank you.
Well, I was going to ask about the cocaine. One of the previous callers mentioned that it had been historically put in there for medical purposes. So my question had been answered. But thank you for taking up my call.
Yeah, Vinny, thanks so much. And Murray, before we go, why don't I just ask you, you know, you set out on this adventure, this exploration. It took you years to write this book. Did you expect what you found? Did you expect the sort of layers of deceit and the how total and how, like you said, being three steps ahead on a chess game, how big this was?
No, and I think that was the more surprising thing. The first surprise was when I started researching the health risks and found that, you know, as I mentioned, that one can a day can really is associated with a great number of health risks. But then, yeah, the aggressive disinformation campaigns really surprised me. And, you know, for one example is there are efforts to preempt new soda taxes in California through the really creative use of front groups. I've been impressed by their organization and creativity in doing this. So, yeah, I was really surprised to see how much of it there is.
And it continues, even though we know all of this. It's not as though they've said, okay, we're going to stop now.
It continues. And one of the things that is really interesting is now we have a whole different sort of regime of how people are getting information. And so Coca-Cola doesn't have to put an ad in your newspaper. They don't have to influence a reporter to put something positive on, you know, CNN or NPR. They're, you know, straight into your phones and into your heads, you know, all the time. And again, I think they're not just Coca-Cola, but a lot of large corporations are way ahead of regulators, health advocates, et cetera, in terms of how to use this new strategies.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Murray Carpenter, a journalist and author, we have been discussing his new book, Sweet and Deadly, How Coca-Cola Spreads Disinformation and Makes Us Sick. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.